Okay. Good morning, everybody. Please apologize that I'm a few minutes late. I had a phone call, and you know how these things are. Let's start. We just have this week and next week, and then we are, no, two more weeks we have, right? No, just next week? Oh my God. Okay. I'm telling too many stories, I guess. But anyways. As you see, I always show the slides right away from our web page. So there was one comment in the evaluation that the slides I show differ from the slides that are in the web. And I don't know what to do with it, because I think I always use the most current version that is available online. So maybe someone can tell me in more detail what happened and what went wrong. Good. So let's talk about image registration. We are currently in our story with the modalities, with pre-processing, with reconstruction, and now we combine things in terms of we use images of one and the same modality and transform them into the same coordinate system, or we also have images of different modalities and fuse them. So we talk about fusion and registration. That's our current chapter. And from 10 or 30,000 feet, looking down to the scene, we see what we did. We capture images, we pre-process single images, we combine multiple images to gain higher information in the reconstruction chapter. And now we take different images acquired at different time points using different modalities, and we merge the information in a way that the radiologist can easily analyze the patient and come up with a proper diagnosis as fast as possible. Okay? That's the story of diagnostic medical image processing. And image fusion is basically defined as, or registration, we look for a translation or a transformation, sorry, a transformation such that the source image is mapped to the target image. How do we call it? And this mapping guarantees that images that we are considering are aligned or registered. And what we did so far is we looked at the simple case, we have corresponding point features. Corresponding point features, and we looked at the situation of 2D points. And last week, no, on Monday, we started to look into the situation where we have corresponding 3D points. So we have here 2D, and here we have 3D registration. Okay. So the first part, and that's just a repetition of what we did on Monday, we can also rewrite the 2D points in terms of complex numbers, where the X coordinate is the real part, the Y coordinate is the imaginary part. And then we use the observation, or we use our knowledge about complex numbers, where we know the fact that the multiplication of two complex numbers is nothing else geometrically than a rotation and a scaling. Yeah? I multiply one complex number with another one, I rotate and scale. the vector. And having this in mind, we can write the optimization problem in terms of complex numbers. And then we just do a comparison of the coefficients. The real part of the left and right side has to be the same. The imaginary part has to be the same. And we end up with linear equations that have to be solved. We did that on Monday. And now we try to do the same for 3D registration. Our goal is to come up with a linear method that allows us to compute the rotation and translation in 3D using just a system of linear, or solving just a system of linear equations. Or in other words, we want to find an SVD-based rotation translation estimator. An SV, I just want to call the function SVD in MATLAB, and that should solve the problem of point-point registration. And to come up with an algorithm like that, we started last week, we started on Monday, to look into different representations of rotation matrices. And we have seen two. We have seen two representations. One is the Euler angle representation, where we say, okay, this matrix can be decomposed into, I think I wrote it this way, phi x, phi y, phi z. This can be decomposed into three rotation, a product, a composition of three rotation matrices around the x, the y, and the z axis. And now you immediately notice that I changed the ordering of the rotations. That, of course, affects the final rotation matrix, because the product of matrices is not commuting. So it makes a difference whether I first rotate around the x-axis and then around the y-axis, or the other way around. For the computer graphics community, they might know that you can assume here that the matrices commute if these angles are very small. If the angles, the rotation angles, are very small between different views, then we say, in terms of a numerical approximation, it doesn't matter in which direction or in which order we multiply the rotation matrices. Huh? So for instance, if you do object tracking where a car is moving and you have 25 images a second and the car is rotating, the rotation can be estimated more or less independent from the ordering, because there are so minor changes that it doesn't matter, the problem of the non-commutative multiplication of matrices. And that's also an engineering task for you later on. If you run into problems with the non-commutativity of matrix multiplication, I mean, just look at a few numbers and whether it's approximately correct for your situation, and then you can do things like that. Yeah? Yeah? Engineers should be aware of the errors they do, and sometimes you can bypass problems that are unsolvable by these nice, I would say, dirty tricks, but it works. Yeah? So, yeah, just be some kind of arrogant and do things like that. Just try it. Yeah? That's engineering. Good. Okay, the second representation was axis angle. Axis angle, the axis angle representation, and the matrix was, and we have shown this by just a few geometric considerations. We have said U is the rotation axis, V is the vector we want to rotate, and the cross product of the two vectors is the third direction. And then we looked what happens to V after the rotation around U, after it is rotated by the angle theta, and we rewrote the final vector, and then we carved out the matrix that is basically characterizing this rotation. And we found out that this is U transpose. So it's a rank one projection matrix given by the rotation vector plus 1 minus U transpose. And I think then we had the cosine, yeah? of theta plus, plus, and then we had this Q matrix, weighted by sine. Okay, that was the third representation, and I also told you how we can switch back and forth between the two representations, yeah, by using the eigenvalue of R, and one eigenvalue of R is 1, because all the points on the rotation axis are mapped to themselves. That means Rx is x, because the points on the rotation matrix are not affected by the rotation. And so by just computing the eigenvector, eigenvalue decomposition of R, we have right away the u. And the theta can be computed out of the other two complex eigenvectors values, where you have sine and cosine terms in it, or you can just compute it by taking arbitrary point and just rotate it by the rotation matrix and compute the inner product of the vector. And this is the representation that is mostly used in computer graphics and computer vision. So we use this quite often, and we can represent a rotation by a 3D vector. Your internal representation in your computer, in your code, can be done by a three-dimensional vector. The orientation of the vector, not the length, the orientation or the magnitude of the vector. The orientation defines the rotation axis, and the magnitude or the length, the Euclidean length of the vector, encodes the rotation angle. Yeah? So you can just represent things by a three-dimensional vector. Okay, good. And the third representation we want to look at are quaternions. May I ask again, who has never heard about quaternions? One, two. Okay, so there are a few. Because if everybody would have heard it two times, then I would just take this chapter out for future lectures, because redundancy is not always a good decision. So we will now represent rotations by quaternions. And the motivation was given by the complex numbers. I told you that you can compute 2D rotations and translations by a convex optimization problem. I wrote the problem two lectures ago to the blackboard without using complex numbers. But the setup with the complex numbers is a nice motivation for us, because now we can say, maybe there is something similar in 3D. Yeah? Maybe there is something similar in 3D, some kind of complex numbers that can be used for rotation representations. And the answer is yes, but it's a little more complicated than complex numbers, or a little more different, let me say it this way. Good, so let's look at this. Let's look at this. Before, let me just summarize here the axis angle representation. How can we get theta and u again? Eigenvalue is one eigenvalue. The other two eigenvalues are these complex ones, yeah, with cosine times I sine, cosine plus I sine, cosine minus I sine, and then you can easily see how you can compute the theta. And theta can also be computed by the trace of R. The trace, you know what the trace is of a matrix? What is the trace, die Spur? Just the sum of the diagonal elements. It's 1 plus 2 times cosine theta, and that's the way you can compute it. These formulas usually you don't remember, yeah? So a very quick and dirty solution is still use a point, rotate it, and compute the rotation angles. It still works the best. Now, quaternions. Quaternions. We know the complex part I, and we require I square to be minus 1. Okay? We want to extend the complex numbers to describe and characterize 3D rotations. We introduce two more of this type, saying j square is minus 1 and k square is minus 1. So we say, ah, okay, there are three numbers that tend to be minus one if you look at the square, okay? The products of these numbers are defined as follows. Ij, here the product is not commuting, is minus ji. Jk is minus k times j is I, and k times I is minus I times k is j. Do you think I ask things like that in the oral exam? I think you should not learn these things. You can look it up. I mean, if I ask a question like this, you can be sure that I don't like you. Yeah? You can be sure I don't like you. There is something going really wrong if I ask a question like that. Then you should really become nervous. And you know what the right answer would be if I ask you how is it defined, you in the imaginary components of quaternions? What should you answer? Yeah, you can say this, or you can even be more personal. You can really attack me and say, I mean, do you know how this is defined? Can you check whether it's correct or not? Yeah. Are you sure? Can you make sure that you don't look it up once I leave the room to check for the correctness? I mean, I did it so often, so I remember these things, but it's not so important. Yeah. Okay, we can look it up. But you have to remember quaternions, we have the three imaginary components. Okay, the square is minus one, and if you mix them together, the product is not commuting and somehow they are linked to each other. That's enough. The rest you can look up. Okay? Or what is the computer scientist solution to this type of definition? You implement a class quaternions, yeah? You test it, and then you just use it and forget about the details. But you implement it just once. Yeah? That's my way of doing things. Good. So what is a quaternion? A quaternion is a linear combination. It's R. And you see here, if you just look at the first two components, it's a complex number, W plus IX. And then we have two additional terms, J times Y, K times C. Yeah? And Y, Z are real numbers. And you trust me that you, of course, can also replace the real numbers by some vectors or by complex numbers, and you can lift the whole concept to other algebraic structures. For us, in the first place, for looking at rotation matrices, it's totally sufficient to look at W, X, Y, and Z to be real numbers. And similar to complex numbers, we now define the following. We define the conjugate. What is the conjugate in complex numbers? If I give you a complex number a plus ib, what is the conjugate?
Turn the sign of the imaginary.
Right. What is the conjugate of 5? That's 5. Okay. How would we expect the conjugate to be for quaternions? Well, we just switch the sign of the imaginary part, and so we get here minus, minus, minus. So intuitively, seems to fit our concept. How is the magnitude, the absolute value of a complex number defined? That's a square plus b square and the square root of it. Yeah, if you have the complex number a plus ib. Yeah, you agree? Okay. How do we do that for quaternions? The same way. We just use the real part, the coefficients, the real coefficients, square them, add them up, and take the square root. Yeah? And written in terms of the conjugate, that's the original quaternion R times the R bar and the square root of it. How would you compute the product of two quaternions? Well, the product of two quaternions, if you have W1 plus I x1 plus j x2 plus k x3 times w2 plus i x2 plus Yeah, X2 is okay. Plus, it looks a little yellowish. It seems that somebody brought color. J, X, sorry, Y. Ah, set two. Okay. Yeah, and then we multiply pairwise, like we used to do things like that for real numbers, taking into consideration that in the case of ix1 times ix2, we have I square is minus 1. Or if we have mixed terms like j times I, that is k, yeah, and we just use the formulas we have seen in the definition, and then we can define the product. And it will turn out that this mapping is a linear mapping. So we also can rewrite this in terms of a matrix mapping of a vector that includes the components W, X, Y, and Z, and we build a matrix out of the first quaternion. So to implement the multiplication, we write it down once, and then we type it in and forget about the details and use it in our software. Okay? A few more definitions. A quaternion R, which has length 1, is called unit quaternion, like a unit complex number. We have a unit quaternion. Why do you think unit quaternions will be important? Right. If we don't use unit quaternions, what do you expect? If we don't use unit quaternions, but any quaternion, we expect a scaling combined with rotation due to our experience with complex numbers. Huh? Oh, we grow in our intuition now a little bit. A few important properties of quaternions. Multiplication and summation are associative. Well, that's not so surprising. Multiplication does not commute. Is that intuitively clear? Yeah, if we express rotations by quaternions, we know rotation matrices, the product doesn't commute, so maybe there is something in it as well. Yeah, doesn't commute. We also have seen in the definition that it doesn't commute because we have this flip of the sign. If we multiply I and J and commute and change the ordering, we get the minus sign. So it doesn't commute. So if you multiply two quaternions, R1, R2, this is not equal to R2, R1. Our conclusion is, and that's for the computer scientists who are a little more familiar with discrete mathematics and algebra, the whole thing is not an algebraic field. Yeah, it's not an algebraic field. The conjugate was defined by switching the norm. By switching the sign, then we have the norm, and the unit quaternion has an additional nice property. If we have a unit quaternion, the inverse quaternion, so if you multiply R with R to the power of minus 1, is supposed to be 1, the inverse quaternion is just the conjugate. Okay? And that's also cool because we know that the inverse of a rotation matrix is what? Stefan? Yes. Yeah. How can you remember this? Well, it's an orthonormal matrix where the column vectors have unit length and the columns are mutually orthogonal, and the inverse of such a matrix is always just the transpose. So if I would, and I'm not, if I would be a math professor for first-year students, and I'm required to explain to you the Gauss-Seidel inversion formula and how to compute the inverse of a matrix, what do you think I will do in the exam, in the written exam? You know, I'm a lazy guy, I don't have time, and I have to correct whether you did the inversion properly. I would use an orthonormal matrix without telling you, or even I would tell you because 75% of the students wouldn't check what's going on. The smart ones, they just write R transposed as an answer to the question, what is the inverse? All the others will just start to do computations. Of course, they will make 5 mistakes on the run. I just look whether the final result is the transpose. Yeah, and then I give you 0 points if you had have a single component not correctly. So simple to correct for. What?
It sounds kind of mean when you tell it like that. Probably
what?
I don't know. Maybe tell it different. It sounds really mean.
I'm not a math professor, so you can be really relaxed. You can be really relaxed. I mean, think about an oral exam, yeah, where you know it's the transpose, the inverse, and the student starts to compute for 30 minutes. I mean, I get paid for it, and you have hard work, and I can easily check whether it's right at the end. Okay, good. You know, mean people make mean comments. And now you are all aware of the fact that I like very much numerical linear algebra. Yeah? I like very much numerical linear algebra. And I always try to move into the direction of linear algebra. Do you think I'm happy to work with quaternions? No, you think I'm not happy with working with quaternions because it's not linear algebra. And now we try to do as much linear algebra as possible in the context of quaternions. And the first is the representation. We represent now a quaternion by a row vector that just carries the real factors. And we forget about I, j, and k. We have a four-dimensional vector. And four-dimensional vectors we are used to, for instance, homogeneous coordinates in 4D we have considered, and we know that we have to interpret these geometrically as 3D points where we just divide by the third component. And here, if I have a 4D vector and I tell you this is a quaternion, then we know that we have to have another picture in mind while working with these four-dimensional vectors. Yeah. Another representation is just to write W, that's the constant, and then take the coefficients of I, j, and k and wrap them or summarize them in a 3D vector. Summarize them in a 3D vector. Okay. So in this notation, the product of two quaternions can now be written in terms of these vectors. So I can do all the work of multiplying two quaternions component by component, and at the end of the day I look how I can express things in terms of matrix products. And what I find out is I get here an inner product of the v vectors of the two quaternions that I multiply, and I see that I also get in here a term which includes the cross product. Yeah? And I'm not deriving this formula. You are required to sit at home tonight and prove that. How would you prove that? Well, you just plug in the components in this formula and do the computation. You just multiply this here with using the definition, and at the end of the day, you compare the two results. Yeah? It's very entertaining if I would do things like that in the lecture on the blackboard. Why is it entertaining? Because I will screw it up with plus and minus, and I will forget two indices, and at the end we will prove that it's not equal. Yeah? And so we will draw the conclusion that we have to sit back home and do it on our own. So I just save the time to do things like that here. Okay? Very technical. Do you think we have to learn this formula? No. The computer scientist solution is check it once, confirm, yeah, convince yourself that it's okay, and then implement this in your quaternion class and use it your lifetime. Yeah? Use it for your lifetime career. Here I did this. You can check it. And it's nice because recently I got an email from a colleague from some other university saying, oh, there is a plus, there should be a minus, and so you have a typo. Okay, things like that happen. Yeah. It should be right now. It should be correct. The nice thing is we can now look at the multiplication, and like we did it with the cross product where we came up with this Q matrix, yeah, we look how we can describe the product of the two numbers by using a matrix vector combination, and we can carve out of the product of two quaternions this matrix that looks a little bit similar, or from a certain distance on a certain abstraction level to this Q matrix, a symmetric, but the sign switch, yeah? So there seems to be some intrinsic similarity, and it looks pretty okay, yeah? But don't learn this matrix. How do you remember this matrix? You just implement it in your quaternion class and use it, yeah, in your implementation. Like we did it here, we can rewrite the product of two quaternions by a matrix vector multiplication. And now we talk about rotation quaternions. So we want to express rotations in terms of quaternions. And let's do the following. The starting point is we have a point P in 3D that has to be rotated. So can you put your hand up and be the point? Yes. So his tip here is the point. We call it P, like point. Then we want to rotate this point around this axis. Keep it. This is the rotation axis. Yeah. So we want to rotate this point around this axis. Make sure that we capture the video properly. Okay, good. She's enjoying music. No? You're listening to me? Oh. I'm so sorry. It's okay. You have a question? Hey, keep the point. It looks nice, right? And now we want to rotate this point by the angle of theta, let's say 180 degrees. Can you do that? So around this, yeah? Around this. And the question is, how can we express this in terms of quaternion operations? Yeah? If we do that in the language of linear algebra with this setup, we take u and theta, we plug it in there, we multiply with the rotation matrix P, and we get P prime. Done, okay? Now we want to do it with multiplications of quaternions. So the rotation quaternion that we have is defined as follows. We say it's cosine theta half, sine theta half times u transpose. Theta is the rotation angle, and u is the rotation axis. That's the unit vector that defines our rotation axis. It's a unit vector, okay? And all the points we are considering in 3D, we transform them into a quaternion. And how do we transform 3D points in homogeneous coordinates? We just add a fourth component that is supposed to be one. How do we transform a point, a 3D point, into a quaternion? We say the components of the 3D point are the prefactors of I, J, and K, and the W is set to zero. So we take the point, take it out, and add a zero at the beginning. That's a nice question in the oral exam. Yeah? Given a point P, rewrite this in terms of homogeneous coordinates, rewrite this in terms of quaternion. Yeah? So I take something of the first part of the lecture, and I take a concept of the last part of the lecture and bring them together with just a single question, and I can check whether you have a gap. Yeah? By the way, if you do the following, and I did that as well when I was also a student, and don't think that I was different. I was very much like you. I was sitting in the back. I was not volunteering for anything. I was not commenting anything. I was just sitting there, and I was hoping that nobody is taking care of me and noticing that I'm there. I also didn't do the homework if it was not required, and all these things. You know that. Why should I be different? I wasn't different. Now I forgot what I wanted to say. Yeah, if you have a gap. If you say, okay, there are four chapters, that's too much for me to prepare. I don't look at the complex numbers and how rotations are computed in complex numbers. That's fine with me if you do things like that. If you go into the oral exam and I ask a question that directly falls into your gap, then you cannot get a 1 anymore. Yeah? You will not get 1.0 and 1.3 if you have a gap. Even if you tell me, look, I didn't look into that, and after 10 seconds we move into a different field, and you have the feeling that all your exam was okay, and you should be very good because all the other answers were brilliant, you have to be sure if you have a gap, and if I will find the gap, you won't get a 1. Okay? That's the rule. My own rule. Okay? That also explains why I didn't have only once during my career. And I survived. Good. So how does the quaternion look like? Once again, cosine, sine, and then we have the rotation axis. And to make it complicated, we divide the angle by 2. Yeah? Do you think that you need to know this formula? Sometimes I ask this. I don't know why, but I like this one. Yeah? I tell you, I like this one. So maybe that sometimes I ask you to convert this into this representation and this representation into this one. Yeah? And this representation, if you don't remember it, you can draw the 2 figures that I have shown to you last lecture and derive it. That's fine with me. Yeah? You don't need to know it by heart. To derive this formula here, it's a pain. Yeah? It's very difficult. And we don't do that now. We have it on the slides. We look at the following. A rotation of a point P can be computed not only by a single product, but by one of these quadratic forms here. The rotated point is R times P prime. P prime, that's the quaternion representation of the point we are considering, times the conjugate of the rotation. Times the conjugate of the rotation, that is, if it's a unit quaternion, the inverse of it. Hmm? So it's not so simple like we have it in the situation of complex numbers where we just had a rotation. Here we have this quadratic form where we multiply from the left and from the right with a quaternion to get the new point. Yeah? And here, if the length or the norm of the quaternion is 1, then we have r to the power of minus 1 is the conjugate. So let's look at the optimization problem now. So we have the point P prime and we have the ice point, and we do that for all point correspondences. So think about the situation. We have here our 3D situation. We have here our points. And we want to compute the rotation here between the two. We say this is equal to, in the language of quaternions, R times P prime times R bar. Okay? Now, if we start to look at the computation of the rotation using the classical representation, we can also say the 3D rotated point is equal to the 3D point mapped by the rotation matrix R. Then we do it for all the points. And of course, if we work with real measurements, the identity will not be valid. So we take the difference and we just measure the length of the difference vector. And here we sum over all the points and all the difference vectors, and we compute the rotation matrix such that this error after the mapping is as small as possible. Okay? In the language of quaternions, we can write this here in terms of sum over I, and then we have P prime rot I. We take the rotated point of the second image minus R P prime R. And we take the length of this quaternion and sum it, and we minimize this with respect to the rotation quaternion. And now, the question is, why don't we like this type of representation by just looking at the formula we see? Can you do the point again? Yes, you have an answer? It's a nice gag, come on.
Non-linear.
It's non-linear, because, you know, if I multiply these two here, this will be linear in R, in the components of R, right? But if I multiply again with R bar, then I will get quadratic terms, and if I take the absolute value, I will have some polynomial in the order of 4. Yeah? So our SVD type of goal is not reached, unfortunately. Our SVD type of goal is not reached so far. So what do we have to do? We have to look at this formula again. So again, we have P rot I is RP prime R bar. If I now do the following, if I multiply, you're not happy? Yeah, go ahead.
When I just substitute P rot of I, then I get exactly zero. So why do we minimize this?
You mean if I come from this to this one?
Yes.
Because there is noise on it, and this identity for all the I's is not fulfilled. In the ideal case, fine, great. This identity is true. We don't know this, we don't know R, so that's a parameterized function, and we minimize that. And if this is zero, we look for the values where this is zero, and if it's numerically approximated and we have noise on it, we try to be as close as possible to zero. That's the idea. Now, so usually we have the situation AX is B, and usually you would say if A is regular, that A to the power of minus 1 B is the solution, okay? But we have the situation that AX is B plus an error vector, yeah? So there is some noise on it. So you cannot just compute the inverse and multiply with B, but you have to deal with the noise, and the noise depends on each measurement, and so we do an approximation such that the final error is minimized. Okay? And this is measured, and this is measured, and the R's are unknown. So even if the identity holds, this one is the proper way to approach the problem of computing R. We have to minimize that. Okay, what do we do now? We assume that R is a unit quaternion, and what we can do is the following. We can take the equation. We can take... Are you representing a point? Okay. Let her explain just the neighbor what we are doing here. Okay, you got it?
I didn't understand this problem.
You didn't understand this problem? Once again? Should I explain it once again?
This problem.
He was saying, this is the same. So if this is the same, the minus should be zero. So the whole optimization problem collapses. That's right. But we don't know R. Yeah, we don't know R, and we have errors, so that's why we look at the difference. It's still a parameterized difference, and we want to find the coefficient such that each component is zero in the idle case, and if we have some noise on the system, we have an optimization problem and compute an approximate solution. Was that correctly your question? It's zero. Yeah. But we don't know R. Good. Good. So let's come back to this formula here. So here we have two multiplications. And we want, at the end, we want a linear problem. We know R. R is supposed to be a unit quaternion. Unit quaternion means length 1, and the inverse is the conjugate. What I can now do is I can multiply from the right, because it's not commuting, from the right, I can multiply with R. I can do that. I have an equation of quaternions, and now I can multiply from the right with another quaternion. And the equation should be fulfilled, right? So I multiply from the right with R. So I have P rot I prime. Any problem? No, that's the quaternion representation of R. So that's, as you have seen, the cosine sine stuff. Yeah, with the cosine half, theta half, and then the sine theta half U transposed. Okay, now the question is, how can I rewrite this rotation times a vector p in the language of quaternions, p prime? And we have seen on the previous slide that a quaternion rotation is given by this, and the definition of a rotation, and you can show this by looking at the components. If you want to rotate a quaternion by a rotation quaternion, you have to compute this here. So if we work with our matrix representation, we say we have to optimize this, but the rotation matrix here is either represented with Euler angles, and we have a nonlinear optimization problem, or if R is represented by the Rodriguez formula, it's also a nonlinear optimization problem because we have these mixed components where the cosine theta times u something shows up. And now we translate this formula using our matrix, our rotation representation in quaternions, into the language of quaternions. Yes? The difference is, if you have a point P in R3 and you want to rewrite it in terms of a quaternion, P prime is 0, and then you have the x component, the y component, and the c component of the vector P. That's the quaternion associated with a point. Yeah? So if you look at two-dimensional vectors, you can rewrite the two-dimensional vector in terms of a complex number, saying x, the x component is the real part, and the y component is the imaginary part. If you transform a 3D vector in a quaternion, the first component is 0, and the weights of I, j, and k are the x, y, and z coordinate.
So then the slice in this problem,
pardon me?
The middle part of the slice, you have 0, p prime.
That's a mistake. That's a lousy mistake. Here it's a, that's not a mistake, that's an inconsistent notation, I would say. Here we say this is the point before the rotation and the other, or without the prime, and the other one is with after the rotation. But here the definition is P prime is 0P. So the notation is inconsistent. So the student who wrote the slides are lousy, please ask Stefan Steidl to do the lecture. Then everything will be fixed. It's not so wrong. Stefan would make this way better than I. You know, I'm one of these hand wavers. Thanks, Stefan. Let me just wipe the board. You just give me the feeling that I was not nicely explaining it. So let's restart again for I think we should take this time. I want to make sure that you get it. So let's again look at two3D volumes. We have here points. We have here points. And we know that these points are mapped from the left side to the right side by a rotation, okay? So we rotate these points. We call, like in the 2D situation, these points pi, and we call these points qi in R3. Okay? If I rotate pi to qi, I have qi is r times pi plus nothing. We just look at rotations. Okay, you agree on that, Natasha? Yes, we are happy. Okay, so if I want to compute R, what I can do is I can sum over all the i's, look at the norm of the difference vector, and minimize this with respect to the parameters that characterize R. That can be either the 3D vector that is defining the rotation angle rotation angle representation, or it can be the 3D angles, rotation around the x, y, and z axis. But in both cases, it will be a nonlinear optimization problem. So on the one hand, we are happy with the equation because we understand it easily. On the other hand, we are unhappy because this is a nonlinear optimization problem. Now we transform it or translate to the language of quaternions. We say Qi prime, that's the quaternion Qi transposed, and Pi quaternion is UPi transposed. Okay? Good. And now we say we can write for all I Qi prime, that's the quaternion, is R times Pi prime R bar. Okay? That's the representation of the rotation in the language of quaternions. Okay? Good. Now I multiply from the right with R, and what I get is Qi R is RPi prime. Any problem, sir?
No.
And here it's linear in R, linear in R. That's cool. So our optimization problem is the following. So our rotation matrix in terms of quaternions is argmin. So we look for the argument that minimizes the sum over I. Why is it so noisy today? Just put yourself in my position. I mean, I'm here fighting, yeah? So we have R, no, we have our notation QIR minus PIR. Yeah. And here we can take the square. Yes. Very, very important. Thank you, sir. And this here is a product of two quaternions, and this one is a product of two quaternions. And we know that we can rewrite products of quaternions in terms of a matrix times a vector. Yeah? And the whole thing is linear in the components of R. So this is linear in the components of R. So we can rewrite this in the language of matrices and do SVD to compute the rotation. So if you use quaternions, we can easily estimate R, the quaternion, the rotation quaternion, by just doing an SVD approach. Now you say, I'm not happy because I don't see it. Well, now you have to go into the components, and I tell you, this is a pain. If you write it in components, But if you just look at this level of representation, it's clear that it's linear in R, and the only work that has to be done, build up the matrix, where you have to compute the pseudo inverse of using the SVD. And that's something you should be able to do during the weekend with a bottle of wine in the back, or some water, or I should not encourage you to have alcohol. I'm sorry for that. Okay. Non-alcoholic beer. That's a good choice. Good. Now Leah is saying to her neighbor, I just saw it, what's about the translation? He did everything with rotation. What's about the translation? Yeah, Stefan, what's about the translation? Yeah, but if we add it here, you know, like we did it with complex numbers, we should add it here. And if we multiply then from the right with R, then we have these mixed structures. So the disadvantage is that we cannot simultaneously estimate R and T using an SVD type of approach. We have to estimate T in advance. How would you estimate T if I give you two point sets that are given, that can be transformed on each other or in a joint coordinate system by using a rotation and translation? Right, you take the mean, you take the center of gravity, then you have an estimate of T, then you do this the normalization, you move the coordinate system into the center of gravity, and then you estimate the rotation. Now Natasha says, hey, that works if the points are correct, yeah, but if you have noise, maybe the estimation of T is not the right one, and this affects the estimation of rotation, so everything is screwed up. What you can do is you can start with an iterative scheme where you estimate T, then you estimate the rotation, then you re-estimate T, you re-estimate R, and then you iterate 3-4 times, and then you will be on the safe side. And I can tell you, if you have points where you know the correspondence of the mean vector is very, very robust. It's a very good estimate. Usually you don't need any iterations. If you would have attended the lecture 10 years ago, I would have told you this is very ugly and, you know, and from an aesthetic point of view, it's not nice and blah, 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 blah. But from a practical point of view, it doesn't matter at all. Yeah? Doesn't matter at all. So Leah is happy now. Yeah? Okay. Good. Why do computer graphics people like quaternions? I mean, they don't estimate rotations. Why?
Because it's again simple to write.
It's for interpolation. Yeah, this guy is brilliant. I mean, imagine the problem. Can you tell me your name again, sir? Your name again? Jan. Jan, you estimate with your algorithm R, the rotation matrix. Yixin is estimating with his algorithm, and he says, I have a way smarter way of computing things, also the R for the same situation. The probability that these matrices are identical is zero if we have real data and different ways how to compute it. Yeah? So they are very similar. Then you, what's your name?
Dominic.
And Stefan is also doing the same thing, and they use their own implementation and they avoid plagiarism. So we have three different rotation matrices. And my experience is, and I come from statistics, if I have four results that differ, I just compute the mean, yeah, and go for the mean. Usually that's better. Yeah? Usually that's the best choice. Even if Jan has an outlier, it's better to use the mean instead of deciding for his solution. Yeah? Okay. So I compute the mean. I give you four rotation matrices, how do you compute the mean? How do you compute the mean?
Maybe the least square estimator.
Least square estimator is not so bad. It's a brilliant idea. You can generally define the mean in terms of a least square estimator. So you take the rotation matrix of him minus the mean rotation matrix square plus, or the norm of it, the Frobenius norm, plus his one minus the mean, plus his one minus the mean, and then you solve this optimization problem. That's right. You can do it this way. But you... What do you say about this type of suggestion? That's the South Bavarian solution to it.
I think I will remove the outliner first.
Okay, so we take just your three matrices. You remove the outlier and do the averaging. It's also not a good good choice. Why? Leah, why? It's bad that I remember your name, right? Max? It's bad that I remember your name, right? Nah, this is that's no. The problem is if you sum two rotation matrices and you divide the final result by two, what happens? You will not end up with an orthonormal matrix. You will no longer have a rotation matrix. Yeah, why don't you just take the rotation, the axis angle representation, you compute the average rotation angle and the average rotation axis, and then build things together using Rodriguez formula, or the setup of quaternions, you can use the mean. That's the nice thing. Yeah, then you can use the mean. And, pardon me?
Nothing else? Correct, you divide the direction with U by 1/4 with four people, and so you can do the same thing, right?
Yeah, that was what I was saying, that you can compute the average rotation axis.
Just
intuition.
On my part.
Okay. Yeah. So if you want to do interpolation, also if you have two rotations and you want to interpolate between rotations, for instance, if you have to implement a video game, yeah, where a car runs. Through Rio de Janeiro, right? And the car has to rotate, and you have two rotation matrices, and you want to have a smooth transition between these two rotation matrices. Yeah? How do you interpolate? And interpolation can be done with quaternions, that it looks smooth and nice. And that's why computer graphics people are using this a lot. We use it for estimation and getting an SVD type of solution to the rotation estimation. Okay? Good. And now we can look at the following problem where I do not even have more than one slide in the manuscript for solving the problem because you already know how to solve it. What did we consider so far? Once again, for our picture, we have to keep in mind what is the lecture about. We have here points. We have RT. And we consider the rigid 2D situation. We understand that, and we are happy that there is a nice solution to it, yeah, with the complex numbers. We have the 3D situation. We have our points, we have rotation and translation, and we can compute stepwise the translation and then the rotation for the 3D rigid case. We have a nice solution, a linear estimator for it, and we are quite happy with it. Okay? We are quite happy with it. And now we look at the following situation. We have an X-ray image, for instance. What is an X-ray image? That's a 2D image. And we have some vessels in it, and where the vessels split up, so where we have a bifurcation, we have a point, so we can identify points in the 2D set. And we have a CT data set. That is a reconstruction. And we have here a rotation, a translation in 3D, and afterwards a projection. So we project the rotated and translated 3D points into the image plane, and we want to get this type of point configuration that we have in the X-ray image. We call that 3D 2D registration. And I can tell you we have a solution for that. And the solution is linear. And I already explained this to you without you remembering it. How can you solve this problem? So imagine yourself in the, or think about the following situation. I'm your boss. I tell you, look, Mr. Roman, we have the problem. The customer is asking for a 3D, 2D registration problem. Software package where he just, you know, selects some points in the CT data set, some points in the X-ray data set, and you have to compute the rotation, translation, and the projection. Can you do that? What is Roman saying? He says, "Ooh, that's complicated. Yeah, I need half a year." And then he goes back to his office and solves it right away, equipped with the knowledge. He got out of this lecture, this brilliant lecture here. Mm-hmm. This is a problem we have already considered, guys. Ladies and gentlemen. Yeah? We have already considered, ladies and gentlemen. I have to be careful. My word is now more considered seriously, what I'm saying. Why? Think about the chapter where we computed the projection matrix. What did we do? We had a calibration pattern with points. We had the points in 3D, and we computed the rotation, translation, and projection using the point correspondences. You remember that? The chapter on calibrating perspective cameras. And we rewrote the whole thing. So if this is PI in R3, and this is QI in R2. We said, I take the projection matrix. I map here the PI vector with the 1 in terms of homogeneous coordinates. And I get QI 1. Up to scaling. Yeah, that's the identity we have considered. And we said this is true for all the I. Yeah? And the projection matrix, we remember. How was the projection matrix defined, Tobias? We had 3 components. Ha ha. Ooh. Pardon me? That's bad. That's bad. What was the first one here from the right, the first component? You don't remember. Rotation and translation. No? What was this one for the perspective projection? That was the projection core. That was And that was the weird matrix with the cotangents. We called that H. Yeah, that was the carrying the intrinsic parameters. If we multiply things together, we get a 3x4 matrix, and we can, and that's what we have seen already. We can estimate P, so the product of all this, we can estimate P by a linear estimator. You can look it up. We have 15 slides on that, how to compute the P, and then we are done. Yeah? And this example should tell you, think across the borders of the chapters we consider. Yeah? Be a fresh mind, look at the problem, and always try to combine things you have already heard of. And sometimes you are very close to a smart solution, and you can easily implement it. Yeah? So Tobias, Max, if your boss asks you for that, you can even use the code you have already written for camera calibration. Yeah? So the only thing is you have to combine the routines you have already implemented in a proper manner, and then you are done with the problem. And then you can tell the marketing people, come up with your marketing brochures and your colored pages explaining the world that we found out a genius solution to the 3D, 2D registration problem that pretty well works, okay? So a linear estimator for 3D, 2D registration. And that's one common question in the oral exam. I asked you, let's use point correspondences. How do we solve it in 2D? How do we solve it in 3D? And how do we solve it in 3D, 2D setups? How can we come up with linear estimators that solve the problem for us? Very, very interesting. Very interesting setup. Huh? I also gave talks about this in many places where I was just explaining this setup, how you can solve this with linear methods. And it's very nice if you are aware of it. Yeah, very powerful. Not very complicated, and that's common knowledge. That's nothing spectacular, but if you have to deal with this type of registration problem, it's actually good to know. I think we should quit here and not start in the final 5 minutes something new. Thank you very much, and see you on Monday.